Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for November 16th, 2021. I am your reader, Peter Welch. Risks to water worry state. Mitchell Company farmers cited by DNR for manure storage tank. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is trying to decide what to do with a cattle producer that built an underground manure tank in karst terrain, a risky area because of the potential for groundwater pollution without getting a permit. Environmental groups are concerned about manure leaks in karst topography because of how quickly contaminants can spread through the Swiss cheese-like bedrock to pollute drinking water wells and streams. Tim and Joe Johnson, owners of Johnson Brothers, a feeder calf operation in Mitchell County, say they didn't know they needed a permit for the tank. The water monitoring system proposed by the Iowa DNR to make sure groundwater in the Cedar River watershed isn't being polluted would cost $100,000, Tim Johnson said. Every solution they came up with will entail spending a lot of money, he told the Gazette in an interview. I said, you can't come up with any other solutions? Johnson thought installing the tank would fix a problem, which was not having a place to put manure during the winter months when Iowa law bans application on frozen ground. On February 2, 2016, the Iowa DNR cited Johnson Brothers for violations including putting manure on frozen ground and not having a manure management plan, according to a consent order filed in 2020. On April 1, 2016, the Johnsons filed a manure management plan and submitted a letter that said that they were consulting with engineers and builders to design and construct an additional manure storage structure, the Iowa DNR reported in the 2020 order. The Johnsons also said that they would submit a construction design letter before beginning any work, the department reported. A few days later, on April 4, 2016, the Iowa DNR sent Johnson Brothers a letter reminding them that they would need a permit for tank construction. But the department never got a design statement or a permit request, the 2020 order states. And yet, when Inspector Sheila Bly visited the facility for a routine inspection, April 17, 2019, there was a new manure storage tank. An investigation near the tank showed karst not much deeper than the 10-foot concrete reservoir, Bly told the Gazette last week. The Sierra Club and other environmental groups have spoken out about their concerns about animal confinements in karst terrain. Leakage from the structure into the soil and then into karst terrain may cause pollution of the shallow aquifer and wells that draw from the aquifer, Steve Vise, an Ames water quality advocate collaborating with the Sierra Club, said in an email Friday to the Gazette. More and more shallow wells in northeast Iowa routinely measure high in nitrate above the 10 parts per million limit and often show levels of E. coli, which is very disturbing. On November 24, 2020, Johnson Brothers signed the consent order, requiring them to pay $10,000 for building the tank without a permit and without following minimum setbacks from karst soils. When an operation fails to comply with the application and permitting process, the department is denied the opportunity to ensure the construction adequately protects the environment and human health, the order states. This failure is particularly concerning when manure storage structures are constructed in karst terrain, as improper construction can have a long-term impact on groundwater in these areas. That order required Johnson Brothers to hire a licensed engineer to investigate the groundwater level around the tank and implement a groundwater lowering system if necessary. The Johnsons got an estimate on the work, but have not done it because it would be too expensive to excavate around the tank, which is only 12 feet away from other tanks, Tim Johnson said. If the pit was out in an open area, it wouldn't be an issue, he said. But it got the existing pits on two sides and a building on a third side. The company has paid the penalty. Bly said she's working with other Iowa DNR officials to decide whether the Johnsons should be allowed to continue using the tank, which had manure in it until recently. We're trying to work out what available options there are so we can be assured we don't have a leaking tank in karst terrain, Bly said. Because the initial plan to monitor groundwater for 6 years is too costly for the producer, the department is trying to come up with options. These could include monitoring nearby wells rather than a groundwater lowering system below the tank, Bly said. But there's also the option of telling the Johnsons they can't use the tank. It's not usually the first option for us, Bly said, but it is a possibility we are considering. The Iowa DNR also doesn't want to force a situation in which a producer can't use a storage tank and then applies the manure on frozen ground, which also has risks to groundwater, Bly said. The Johnsons now are keeping fewer than 500 calves, which means they are classified as a small animal feeding operation. We're working through that process now, Bly said. The Iowa DNR hopes to have a decision in coming weeks. And in other news, Mason City man is given a life sentence for murder. Benjamin Gonzalez shot man during argument March 31st. A Mason City man convicted of fatally shooting a man during an argument last March will spend his remaining years in prison for the crime. Benjamin Bravo Gonzalez, 39, was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole on Monday in Cerro Gordo County District Court. The court session began with a motion by Gonzalez to be assigned new counsel because he believed he had been inadequately represented by his court-appointed defense team, headed up by Mason City Attorney Parker Thurnbeck. Judge Dedra Schroeder questioned Gonzalez as to whether he was asking for a new counsel for the sentencing process or for his intent to appeal. Gonzalez conferred with his attorneys and withdrew his request. Thurnbeck then appealed to the court for a new trial for citing the defense's belief that Gonzalez was unable to receive a fair trial. The motion was denied. Gonzalez was convicted on August 13th of first-degree murder in the shooting death of 36-year-old Michael Creveston. Witnesses say that Gonzalez shot Creveston the night of March 31st near the intersection of North Jefferson Avenue and 3rd Street Northwest during an argument between the two men. Creveston was transported to Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center, where he died of his injuries. Gonzalez fled the scene and evaded capture for nearly a week. He was eventually tracked to Kossuth County by State Department of Criminal Investigation and was arrested in Algona by local police. Gonzalez was spotted by an officer on April 6th and was arrested after an hours-long standoff in which Gonzalez barricaded himself in the attached garage of a residence. No one was injured in the standoff. During Gonzalez's trial, prosecutors said that Creveston and his girlfriend, Sarah Raymond, were walking to the liquor store on Monroe Street to get cigarettes for Creveston's mother when the two encountered a car with Gonzalez and two other people inside. Creveston and Gonzalez began arguing, and then Raymond pulled Creveston away. As the two were walking away, Gonzalez got out of the car and said something to the effect of, "M, I got this for you," according to prosecutors. Creveston was shot in the chest as he turned around and told Raymond to call 911 because he was unable to breathe. Gonzalez fled the scene. Three other people were in the car with Gonzalez during the shooting, including Gonzalez's toddler son, according to witnesses who testified during the trial. And one of them told police she was with Gonzalez later when she saw him throw something into Willow Creek. The weapon used in the shooting was not recovered. Gonzalez's defense attorney called no witnesses nor presented any evidence, but instead made a motion for the immediate acquittal of Gonzalez on the charges of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and involuntary manslaughter on the grounds that the state failed to meet the burden of proof that Gonzalez was at the scene of the crime. That motion was denied. After his sentence was handed down, Gonzalez read a prepared statement to the court, renewing his request for a new trial. First and foremost, I would like to address the court and make it known that I believe that there was multiple reasons with my case should be heard before a new jury, Gonzalez said. He then went on to outline seven reasons he believed his case deserved reconsideration and asserted his innocence once again. No family or friends of Priveston's who were in the attendance chose to attend or to address the court. A first-degree murder conviction carries a mandatory life sentence in the state of Iowa. Since the crime is a Class A felony, Gonzalez is entitled to an automatic appeal. And as Olina's seeking new ownership, pizza place to remain open during sale. A Clear Lake favorite is currently in the process of seeking new ownership. According to Christy Wilkie of Hall Realty, the owner of the well-known pizza place Azalina's Hole in the Wall has listed the business for sale. According to a listing on Hall Realty's website, the asking price for Azalina's, which is located at 425 Main Street, sits at $259,000. The price includes the business, the operating space of the business, and the apartment complex on the second floor. Wilkie said that the listing has been up for around a week and is garnering some attention from prospective buyers. We've had a couple of calls so far, Wilkie said, of definitely some interest already. For now, Azalina's will remain open, continuing to serve its signature Italian dishes, operating 5 to 8 p.m., Thursday through Sunday nights. According to Wilkie, the hope is for Azalina's to continue as a restaurant after it is sold. We're hoping to keep it the way it is and keep a thriving downtown business, Wilkie said. And nationally, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, prosecutor Rittenhouse provoked the bloodshed. Kyle Rittenhouse provided bloodshed on the streets of Kenosha by bringing a semi-automatic rifle to a protest and menacing others, and when the shooting stopped, he walked off like a hero in a Western, a prosecutor said in closing arguments Monday at Rittenhouse's murder trial. But Rittenhouse's attorney countered that the shooting started after the young man was ambushed by a crazy person that night and became afraid his gun was going to be wrested away and used to kill him. Rittenhouse, then 17, killed two men and wounded a third during a tumultuous night of protests against racial injustice in the summer of 2020, a case that has stirred bitter debate in the U.S. over guns, vigilantism, and law and order. Rittenhouse said he went to Kenosha from his home in Antioch, Illinois, to protect property from rioters in the days after a black man, Jacob Blake, was shot by a white Kenosha police officer. Rittenhouse, a former police youth cadet, is white, as were those he shot. In closing arguments, prosecutor Thomas Binger repeatedly showed the jury drone video that he said depicted Rittenhouse pointing the AR-style weapon at demonstrators. This is the provocation. This is what starts this incident, the prosecutor declared. He told the jury, "You lose the right to self-defense when you're the one who brought the gun, when you are the one creating the danger, when you're the one provoking other people." Rittenhouse, now 18, faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison if convicted of the most serious charge against him, first-degree intentional homicide, which is Wisconsin's top murder charge. Binger zeroed in on the killing of 36-year-old Joseph Rosenbaum, who was the first man gunned down that night and whose shooting set in motion the ones that followed. The prosecutor repeatedly called it murder, saying it was unjustified. The prosecutor reminded jurors that Rittenhouse testified he knew Rosenbaum was unarmed. Binger also said there is no video to support the defense claim that Rosenbaum threatened to kill Rittenhouse. Binger disputed the contention that Rosenbaum was trying to grab Rittenhouse's rifle. Mr. Rosenbaum is not even within arm's reach when the first shot occurs, Binger said. He rejected the claim that Rittenhouse had no choice but to shoot, saying he could have run away. And Binger argued that once Rosenbaum was wounded, he was not even capable of taking away the gun, which was strapped to Rittenhouse's body, since he was falling to the ground with a fractured pelvis. Rittenhouse kept firing, delivering what the prosecutor called the kill shot to Rosenbaum's back. I think we can also agree that we shouldn't have 17-year-olds running around our streets with AR-15s, because this is exactly what happens, Binger said. After killing Rosenbaum, Rittenhouse shot and killed Anthony Huber, 26, and wounded Gage Grosskreutz, 28, while trying to make his way through the crowd. Rittenhouse testified that Huber hit him with a skateboard and that Grosskreutz came at him with a gun of his own, an account largely corroborated by video and Grosskreutz himself. But the prosecutor said that Rittenhouse provoked that bloodshed too. He said Huber, Grosskreutz, and others in the crowd were trying to stop what they believed was an active shooter. When it was all over, Rittenhouse walked away like a hero in a Western without a care in the world for anything he's just done, Binger said. In his own closing argument, defense attorney Mark Richards called Rosenbaum a rioter and a crazy person who went after Rittenhouse unprovoked. Mr. Rosenbaum was shot because he was chasing my client and going to kill him, take his gun, and carry out the threats he made, Richards said, adding that Rittenhouse never pointed his gun before being chased. It didn't happen. Richards said that Rittenhouse was then attacked by a mob. The defense attorney accused prosecutors of calling Rittenhouse an active shooter because of the loaded connotations of that word, and in an apparent reference to the police shooting of a black man that touched off the protests, Richard said, other people in this community have shot people 7 times, and it's been found to be okay. No charges were brought against the white officer. When the prosecutor displayed a photo of Rosenbaum's bloodied body on a gurney during his autopsy, another of his mangled hand, some jurors appeared to avert their eyes. Later, when Binger displayed a close-up of Grosskreutz's bicep largely obliterated by a bullet, several jurors winced and turned away. As he spoke, Binger walked up to the jury box and lifted Rittenhouse's rifle as if it were firing, pointing the weapon at a wall. Jurors appeared riveted when Richards, the defense attorney, began addressing them in his booming voice. The sound of a small group of protesters chanting outside the building could be heard at one point during the defense closing, but it wasn't clear from inside the courtroom what they were saying. Supporters have hailed Rittenhouse as a hero who took a stand against lawlessness. Foes have branded him a vigilante. Binger began his closing argument by questioning whether Rittenhouse was genuinely trying to help. The prosecutor noted that Rittenhouse had ammunition, capable of traveling the length of 5 football fields and passing through cars, and asked the jury, "Why do you need 30 rounds of full metal jacket ammo to protect a building?" In other local news, NIACC offers free nurses' aid training. North Iowa Area Community College is offering a new 4-week nurse aid training program. Start the 75-hour training program on December 20th, complete the training by January 14th, take the state's certificate exam, and then start employment as a certified nurse assistant, or CNA. This 4-week nurse aide training is free for Iowa residents, and IACC has programs that can assist with tuition, books, uniforms, testing fees, and transportation costs. Navigators assist students by monitoring progress, problem solving, and finding employment after training. To learn more about the training option and the free support, contact Pathway Navigators, Melanie at 641-422-4078. That's 641-422-4078. Or Angela at 641-422-4312. That's 641-422-4312. Navigators will walk you through the application process. Applications will be taken until the class is full or until November 30th, whichever comes first. And today in history. Today is Tuesday, November 16th, the 320th day of 2021. There are 45 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On November 16th, 1914, the newly created Federal Reserve Banks opened in 12 cities. On this date, the 1907 Oklahoma became the 46th state of the Union. In 1933, the United States and the Soviet Union established diplomatic relations. In 1945, The Friendly Ghost, an animated short featuring the debut of Casper, was released by Paramount's Cartoon Division. In 1961, House Speaker Samuel T. Rayburn died in Bonham, Texas, having served as Speaker since 1940, except for 2 terms. In 1981, the Senate confirmed Dr. Everett C. Koop to be Surgeon General. Oscar-winning actor William Holden, 63, was found dead in his Santa Monica, California apartment. In 1982, an arrangement was announced in the 57th day of a strike by National Football League players. In 1989, 6 Jesuit priests, a housekeeper, and her daughter were slain by Army troops at the University of Central America's Jose Simon Kansas in El Salvador. In 1991, former Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards won a landslide victory in his bid to return to office, defeating State Representative David Duke, a former Ku Klux Klan leader. In 2001, investigators found a letter addressed to Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat of Vermont, containing anthrax. It was the second letter bearing the deadly germ known to have been sent to Capitol Hill. In 2004, President George W. Bush picked National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to be his new Secretary of State, succeeding Colin Powell. In 2006, Democrats embraced Nancy Pelosi as the first female House Speaker in history, but then selected Steny Hoyer as Majority Leader against her wishes. In 2018, a U.S. official said intelligence officials had concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had ordered the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. 10 years ago, President Barack Obama, visiting Canberra, said he would send military aircraft and up to 2,500 Marines to Northern Australia for a training hub to help allies and protect American interests across Asia. 5 years ago, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, addressing a UN conference in Morocco, made a stirring appeal to all countries, including his own, to press ahead with the fight against climate change, saying a failure to do so would be a betrayal of devastating consequences. Former Congressman and Defense Secretary Melvin Laird, 94, died in Fort Myers, Florida. 1 year ago, President-elect Joe Biden warned of dire consequences if Presidential Donald Trump said his administration continued to refuse to coordinate with his transition team on the coronavirus pandemic and kept blocking briefings on national security policy issues and vaccine plans. Biden told reporters more people may die if we don't coordinate, as officials in Nevada's most populous counties certified results of the election. Trump took to Twitter with a new attack on the vote count that gave Biden a 33,596 vote statewide victory. A second experimental COVID-19 vaccine, this one from Moderna Incorporated, yielded extraordinarily strong early results. Moderna said that the vaccine appeared to be 94.5% effective. And let's now turn to Iowa City. Air guns under fire in Iowa. In Iowa City, a loophole in the law that local authorities hope to close has prevented the Johnson County Attorney's Office from pressing serious charges against the man identified as shooting a projectile into the head of a passing Marine and badly injuring him. Iowa City Police said that on October 17th, Philip Olson, 69, was shooting at a squirrel in his yard with an air rifle, but missed and instead hit Lance Corporal Gabe Heifner, 20, as he was driving on Highway 6 near Sycamore Street. The Marine, who crashed after being shot, was severely injured. Last week, he was transferred from the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics to a clinic in Chicago. Olson faces fines for violating city code and Iowa Department of Natural Resources regulations after he voluntarily came forward to police shortly after the shooting. But authorities say that they were blocked from charging him with a crime because air rifles are not considered dangerous firearms under Iowa law. Olson declined to comment when reached by the Gazette. Unlike firearms that use gunpowder, non-powder guns such as BB and pellet guns use air pressure, carbon dioxide pressure, or spring action to launch the projectiles. There are no federal laws regulating the transfer, possession, or use of non-powder guns. More than half of state, including Iowa, do not regulate them either. The Marine's family and Democratic Johnson County Attorney Janet Lyness say they favor legislation to classify these guns as firearms. At least two of Iowa's Democratic senators are in the early stages of discussing the incident ahead of the legislative session. It does seem like there is a loophole in the law, because it's something that's not defined as a firearm, a dangerous weapon, which makes it hard to prosecute. Linus said, people think of them as a toy or BB guns, and they're not. They're lethal weapons, and they should be treated the same way as firearms. But rather than enact more gun restrictions, the Iowa legislature has been heading in the opposite direction. Earlier this year, passing a constitutional carry measure, making it optional to obtain a permit to buy or carry a handgun. And along party lines, where Democrats are outnumbered in both chambers, lawmakers gave final approval to putting a state constitutional amendment about gun rights before Iowa voters in 2022. In addition, the odd nature of the incident may not fuel much desire to address with a new law what could be seen as a tragic fluke. Senator Julian Garrett, Republican of Indianola, said he read about the incident after being contacted by the Gazette. Garrett, vice chair of the Standing Judiciary Committee, said he wasn't sure if a legislative change was needed, given the rare circumstances, but added that he hadn't much time to even think about it. My initial thought is this could happen anywhere. It happened in town, but it could have just as well been out in the country. I don't know if this is something that needs more legislation, Garrett said. Garrett said some initial questions he has are whether something similar has happened in other states and how likely something like this is to happen again. You're listening to the reading of the Globe Gazette for November 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Scott Jordan Green, 28, passed away unexpectedly on Saturday, November 13th at the University of Iowa Hospital. A funeral service will be held 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 19th at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church at 722 North Adams Avenue, Mason City. A live stream will be available on the Epiphany Parish Facebook page. Burial will be held in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, November 18th at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel at 126th 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City. A vigil service will begin at 6:45 p.m., and there will be time for sharing. Memorials may be directed to the address of 615 Mabin Avenue, Garner, in Iowa, 50438 zip code. Scott was born on August 21st, 1993, in Mason City, the son of Tony and Michael Coopinger Green. He was a graduate of Mason City High School's class of 2011. Since his sophomore year of high school, he worked at North Iowa Vocational Center. Many words could be used to describe Scott, but the one most commonly found is loving. Scott could light up a room and make others feel welcome. He was very charismatic and loving around other people. Scott could make a friend anywhere he went, regardless of if they were a stranger or not. He was the only boy to four sisters whom he loved unconditionally. Scott was fearless and protective of his family, always wanting to be the most informed. He was a good interrogator, making sure he knew everyone's schedule. Scott loved sports, especially participating in Special Olympics, bowling, basketball, and cheerleading. He was a big fan of the Iowa Hawkeyes, the Minnesota Vikings, and the NASCAR. Scott was his nephew's number one fan, always being the loudest in the crowd. Music brought Scott a lot of joy. If he wasn't listening to it, he was creating his own. Again, services will be held at the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel at 126th Street, 3rd in Northeast Mason City. And the telephone number there is area code 641-423-2372. And you can also go online at colonialchapels.com. Mary M. Daly has passed at the age of 75 in Mason City from complications due to COVID. She was born to Vernon Daly and Helen Leigh Daly in Algona, in Iowa, on January 23, 1946. She was an accomplished clarinet player and loved music. Daly attended Lou Verne High School, graduating in 1964. After graduation, she attended AIB College of Business in Des Moines and worked as an accountant for Bankers Life. Returning to school, she graduated from Mankato State University with a degree in social work in 1971. Daly worked at Handicap Village in Mason City and later as a social worker in Cedar Rapids in St. Paul, Minnesota. Before retiring, she worked as an accountant for Hennepin County. Daly was a deeply involved member of St. Matthew Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. She's remembered for her pro-life work and as a prayer warrior who rarely missed Mass. At St. Matthew, she was a leader of the Sanctity of Life Committee and traveled regularly to Des Moines in assistance to Iowa Right to Life. In 2004, she co-founded the Coalition for Life of Iowa, which defends the sanctity of human life from conception with prayer, education, and raising awareness. She served as Coalition's VP and member of the Board of Directors. Daly continued as a prayer warrior for life from her nursing homes. Visitation will be held at Holy Family Catholic Church in Mason City on Thursday, November 18th at 10 a.m. The funeral mass will be at the same location at 11 a.m. In Nora Springs, Marvel M. Squeer, 92, of Nora Springs, has passed. In keeping with her wishes, cremation has taken place, and Marvel's family will hold a private graveside service at the Evergreen Cemetery in Rudd. The daughter of Harold and Thelma Schultz, Noah, Marvel Marie, was born on July 28, 1929, in rural Rockford on the family farm. She attended Rock Grove Country School through 8th grade and graduated from Rudd High School in the class of 1947. On October 27, 1947, Marvel was united in marriage to Gail Ethington in Silver Springs, Maryland. They would be blessed with 3 sons, Gregory, Thomas, and Bradley. Marvel and Gail shared nearly 40 years together until his passing on September 13, 1984. Marvel was also one to keep busy. She was an active member within the Rudd United Methodist Church and the Ladies American Legion Auxiliary. In her free time, she enjoyed playing golf, bridge, bowling, sewing, embroidering, quilting, and bird watching. She also worked as a stone clerk for Spurgeon's for a number of years. On November 1, 1997, Marvel married Burr Squire at the Rudd United Methodist Church, and they would be blessed with 19 years of marriage until Burr's death in April of 2016. Again, you can hear more about the services at Schechler Colonial Chapel at 114 North Hawkeye Avenue in Nora Springs, or you can also go online at colonialchapels.com. Mark A. Trees, age 72, has passed, of Forest City. Mark was born to Marvin A. and Marjorie J. Johnson Trees on May 12, 1949, in Estherville, Iowa. He attended Forest City Community School and graduated in 1967. Upon graduating from Drake University, Mark returned to Forest City and was a partner with his father, raising Hereford cattle. Later, he worked at Home Federal Savings and Loan, Manufacturers Bank and Trust, both in Forest City. Mark is remembered for his dedication to family and his love of the outdoors. Memorials may be directed to Good Samaritan Society Hospice at 24090 Smiley Road in Suite 201 in Nisswa, that's Nisswa, Minnesota, and the zip code is 56468. Private family services are being held. Also, Mark Kyle, 67, a Brit, passed away on Sunday, November 14th, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. Funeral service for Mark will be held on Saturday, November 20th, at 10:30 a.m. at Ewing Funeral Chapel at 178 Center Street West in Britt, with Jerry Myers officiating. Visitation will be held on Friday, November 19th, from 5 to 7 p.m., and 1 hour prior to services on Saturday at Ewing Funeral Chapel. You can also go online at www.ewingfuneralhome.com. Ewing Funeral Chapel at 178 Center Street West Britt in Iowa. And the phone number there is 641-843-3839. And Jerry Weir of Clarion, age 76, has passed on Saturday, November 14th, at the Iowa Specialty Hospital in Belmont. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, November 17th, at the Clarion Church of Christ, 420 North Main Street in Clarion, with Pastor Warren Curry officiating. Visitation will be held from 9:30 a.m. to 11 o'clock in the church on Wednesday. You can also go online at www.ewingfuneralhome.com. And the address there is 1801 Central Avenue East in Clarion. And the telephone number is 515-532-2233. Lois Paula Stratman, age 89, has passed on Saturday, November 13th at Franklin Country View Nursing Facility in Hampton. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. until 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 17th at Trinity Lutheran Church in Hampton. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 18th at Trinity Lutheran Church, with burial taking place in the Trinity Lutheran Cemetery in rural Hampton. The Syed Sema Vogel Funeral Home of Hampton is assisting Lois's family, and they can be also looked up on the internet at www.syetsemavogelfuneralhomes.com. In other obituary news, in Brit, Donna Fisher, age 81, has passed away as of November 12th at the Mercy One Johnson Hospice Care in Johnston. Funeral services for Donna will be held on Wednesday, November 17th at 11 a.m. at the Brit United Methodist Church at 707 4th Street Southwest in Brit, with Pastor Robert Dodge officiating. Burial will be held at Oaklawn Cemetery in Oakland, in Iowa, on Thursday, November 18th at 1 p.m. Visitation will be held on Tuesday, November 16th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Ewing Funeral Chapel at 178th Center Street West in Brit, and continue 1 hour prior to services at the church on Wednesday. And you can locate them on the internet at www.ewingfuneralhome.com. And their address is Ewing Funeral Chapel, 178th Center Street West in Brit. Their telephone number is area code 641-843-3839. Margaret A. O'Borney has passed, age 78, in her home in Garner. A funeral mass will be held 10:30 a.m. on Monday, November 22nd, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Duncan, with Reverend Andrew Marr officiating. The service will be live streamed on the Cadaldo Funeral Home Facebook page. Burial will be at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Duncan. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 21st, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Duncan, with a combined Catholic Workmen, FCSLA, and Catholic Daughters of America Rosary at 1:30 p.m. and a scriptural wake service at 5 p.m. Visitation will resume 1 hour prior to services at the church on Monday. Masks are suggested at both the visitation and the funeral mass. And you can locate the funeral home at Cataldo Cataldo Funeral Home. And you can go online at www.cataldofuneralhome.com. You can also contact them by phone at area code 641-923-2841. And finally, in obituary news, Jeffrey Jean Jeff Moore has passed in a fatal motorcycle accident in Kansas City, Missouri, on his way to the Ozark Mountains. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 19th, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Graveside services will be held Saturday, November 20th, 11 a.m. at Oakwood Cemetery, Plymouth, with Reverend Scott Davis officiating. And now let's turn to sports. College cross country, NIACC crowns champion at national meet. Sarah Petrie makes Trojans history by winning title. It was quite the weekend for head coach Curtis Vase and the NIACC men's and women's cross country teams. The Trojans took part in the NJCAA Division II National Cross Country Meet in Mechanicsville, Virginia, on Saturday. Sophomore Sarah Petrie did something no woman has ever done before in the history of the program. She led the race from start to finish, winning NIACC's first individual national title by 16 seconds. She ran a time of 18 minutes, 21 seconds on the 5-kilometer course at Pole Green Park. After winning the individual national title in 2020, sophomore Melvin Kipkomboi followed it up with a third-place finish this year. He finished the 8-kilometer race at 25 minutes and 4 seconds, which was 12 seconds behind the first-place finisher, Cowley County's Adrian Lopez. NIACC's next best finisher was Peyton Sealer, who placed 51st in a time of 27 minutes and 51 seconds, followed by Christian Rodriguez, 78th place at 28 minutes and 23 seconds, Richard Morcoke's 99th place at 28 minutes and 55 seconds, Braden Julesgaard, 103rd place at 29 minutes, Caleb Sled at 146th place at 30 minutes and 04 seconds, and Maxwell Dieter at 213th place at 34 minutes and 38 seconds. And in Mason City, times improved for Mohawks at state meet. Nearly every Mason City swimmer cut time on biggest stage. The Mason City girls swimming team has been performing at its best lately. Nearly every swimmer for the Mohawks at the state swimming meet held on Friday and Saturday at Marshalltown dropped time during their respective events, which was something head coach Steve Hugo was proud of. "We were excited about that," Hugo said. "There were some disappointments that we didn't make into the scoring rounds, but I'm pleased with what we did. Cutting the time at the state meet is pretty tough to do if you're rested completely just to get there." The Mohawks ended up scoring 10 points between two events, which was good for a 28th place finish out of 32 teams. The big scorer for Mason City was its 200-yard medley relay team on Saturday. The team of senior Kate Edgerton, junior Taylor Halverson, and sophomores Aspen Cole and Grace Hare placed 13th in a time of 1 minute 52.42 seconds, which scored 8 points for the Mohawks. "We were a little bit slower, but surprisingly, more teams went slower," Hugo said. "We moved up one spot, so we scored points in that." The only other points that were scored were by junior Rosa Monarch. She started off Mason City's state meet by placing 15th in diving on Friday. Monarch, who was seeded 19th, managed to break into the top 16 of the leaderboard with her score of 401.75 points. With her 2 points contributed to the team score, Monarch is the first Mason City diver since 1999 to record points for the Mohawks. "She got points, and the swimmers were there," Hugo said. "They came to watch as much diving as they could before they had to head out and get a light lunch before the preliminaries. They were real excited about Rosa got points on the board for the swimming and diving team to start things off." After Monarch and the divers finished up on Friday, all of the individual race prelims got underway. No Mason City swimmer made it past the preliminary races, but almost all cut times from the regional meet. After the 200-yard medley relay, Mason City's two other relay teams improved placements in the state meet from where they were originally seated. Seated 29th, the 200-yard freestyle relay team of Edgerton, Taylor Halverson, and juniors Marie Manternock and Jenna Brown swam at 1.43.72 to move up to 23rd. Rounding out the meet, the 400-yard freestyle relay team of Hare, Manternock, Brown, and Cole just missed out on a point, placing 17th with a time of 3.43.68. Hugo was proud of his team's growth this season and encouraged about the future of the program. The Mohawks only say goodbye to one senior, who happens to be Edgerton, that qualified for state this season. He hopes to see more swimmers this offseason take part in summer training and the Mason City Youth Swimming Program. "That's exciting as well," Hugo said. They saw how close they were in some of the relays, at regionals, and in some of the individual events. I hope that inspires them. And moving on to college football, the Iowa Hawkeyes, difference-making transfers help Iowa. Jones' 72-yard touchdown, Van Valkenburgh's 10 tackles key in on win. In their own way, during Iowa's 27-22 win Saturday over Minnesota, Charlie Jones and Zach Van Valkenburgh proved why they belong. The two Hawkeye transfer, Jones, arriving as a walk-on after beginning his college career at Buffalo, and Van Valkenburgh as a graduate transfer from Division II Hillsdale College, each provided difference-making moments of Kinnick Stadium. Jones caught a 72-yard touchdown pass in the third quarter and set up a second quarter score with a 34-yard reception. Van Valkenburgh's collection of 10 tackles, including 3 tackles for a loss and a fourth quarter sack that buried the Golden Gophers' Tanner Morgan at his 3-yard line. "This is exactly why I came here, to be a part of the games like this. I left a scholarship behind so that I could play in the Big Ten," Jones said. "It was tough for me and family, but I knew it would one day be worth it. Moments like these, that is exactly why I came here." Van Valkenburgh can relate. "It feels good to be part of a win like this," the sixth-year senior said. Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said the growth of both players since arriving is similar to the way the Hawkeyes continue to grow as a team. "Players change just like our team," Ferentz said. "They grow, they improve. I'll go back to another guy, Jack Heflin, had a nice career at Northern Illinois, came over and fit in really well with us. I'll say the same about Charlie and Zach." Different week. Hawkeye notes, the first career start for Alex Padilla at quarterback came complete with a few nerves and some added stress during the week that ended with a win. "I have a great group of guys around me, supporting me, and that part has been great," Padilla said. "It's been a great week, something I've always dreamt about." Padilla praised the help that he received on the sideline from injured Spencer Petras. Petras was not able to throw Saturday and spent warm-ups around his teammates. Ferentz said his ability for next weekend's game against Illinois remains undetermined. Rare lead when Minnesota kicker Matthew Trickett hit a 31-yard field goal as time expired in the second quarter. It left the Golden Gophers with a 13-10 halftime lead. The advantage marked the first time Minnesota had held a lead over Iowa since the fourth quarter of a 2016 game between the two teams. The span between Golden Gophers led covered 275 minutes, 28 seconds of action between the teams. And finally, Wilson shutout for first time on surprising NFL day. Russell Wilson was shut out for the first time in his career. Taylor Heinicke outplayed Tom Brady. Aaron Rodgers had fewer touchdowns than Cam Newton. Another Sunday was filled with upsets and unpredictability. For the second straight week, four teams with losing records beat clubs that entered in first place or tied for first. It started with Miami knocking off Baltimore on Thursday night. Washington defeated Tampa. Carolina routed Arizona. Minnesota edged the Chargers. Even the Detroit Lions joined in on the surprises by avoiding a loss for the first time. Wilson made a remarkable return from a severe finger injury, only to throw a pair of picks in the end zone in Seattle's 17-0 loss to Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. Wilson wouldn't make excuses, but he was rusty after missing three games. This could have been a big, big step for us here to get this win on the road, Wilson said. Unfortunately, because of my mishaps here and there, it didn't happen that way. I look forward to watching the tape and seeing where I can get better and where we can get better. And that does it for today's reading of the Globe Gazette for November 16th, 2021. I'm your reader, Peter Welch. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.